Angels in America is one or two, depending on how you slice it, of the most important plays of the last 25 years. It's set in New York during the AIDS crisis of the 1980s and revolves around two couples and a caustic fireball of a lawyer named Roy Cohn. In this clip from the 2003 HBO miniseries that Tony Kushner adapted from his play, Al Pacino's Roy Cohn is in a hospital bed dying of AIDS, and Jeffrey Wright is the nurse who's taking care of him.
Fucking hate hospitals, nurses. You know, waste of time, weakness, and wasting. I want to kill it. You can't kill this, though, can they?
No.
It's too simple. It knows itself. It's harder to kill someone that knows what it is. Like pubic lice. You ever have pubic lice?
That's none of your business.
I picked up some super crabs once from some kid. Took 20 drenchings of quail, finally shaving, to get rid of the little bastards. Nothing could kill them. And every time I had an itch, I'd smile because I learned to respect them. These unkillable crabs, because I learned to identify. Determined lowlife, like me. You seen lots of guys with this?
Lots.
So, how do I look, comparatively?
I'd say you're in trouble.
I'm gonna die soon. That was a question.
Probably so.
I appreciate the honesty.
That exchange, like so much of Angels in America, is simultaneously wry and devastating. Al Pacino and Jeffrey Wright both won Emmys for their performances in the miniseries. Pacino for raw alpha male assholery, and Wright for bite and sensitivity. And that's just two of the play's cast of characters. Writer and theater director Isaac Butler and Slate editor Dan Coyce followed the play from its beginning in Tony Kushner's dreams 25 years ago through the Broadway revival that's in production right now in their new book, The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America. Isaac Butler sat down with me to talk about the history of the play and the new book. Isaac Butler, I really appreciate you talking to me. Let me ask, I want to start first with just the play as the play. How many times have you seen Angels in America?
I have seen Angels in America many times. I have seen it live three times, and I will see it two more times this year. I've seen the HBO miniseries many times, and I've seen video recordings of productions a few times as well.
The production that's in New York right now with both parts, I don't know if you refer to them as parts or separate plays. How do you call the two parts?
Well, that's quite a difficult ontological question. Uh-huh. Angels in America is both a play in two parts, or you can think of it as two separate plays. I mean, each one of those plays can be performed independently of the other. The first one is called Millennium Approaches, and the second play is called Perestroika. And of course, for many years, Millennium Approaches, the first part, was the only play that existed, and it ends on a cliffhanger. And so one of the struggles that our book documents is Tony Kushner, the author's struggle to write that second part, Perestroika, you know, and to resolve all of the arcs that he had gotten halfway through by the end of Millennium Approaches in a way that lived up to the promise and attention of this play that had already been anointed as, you know, the next great work of American literature and theater.
Was the first part just called Angels in America when there was only one part, or was it, did he always contemplate it as chapter one?
Well, always is an interesting question, actually. Humorously enough, when he first set out to write Angels in America, it was going to be one play that was under 2 hours long and was a sort of chamber play about five gay men with songs. Almost none of that is what the play turned out to be by the time he was done with it. For one thing, the theater company that commissioned it, their acting company was three women and one man. So he had to write roles for three women. For another thing, not all of them could sing. So it stopped being a musical. But then the other thing that Kushner found as he worked on it was that, you know, Angels in America is a play fundamentally at its heart about the nature and possibility of change. And he couldn't get the characters to change fast enough to get it done in 1 2-hour play. And so, you know, the first play, Millennium Approaches, ends very famously with an angel crashing through the ceiling. That was originally supposed to be the midpoint of the full play, when it was going to be one play. And, you know, Tony Kushner's writing, and he gets to the point where, you know, he's written 120 pages or whatever, and the angel hasn't crashed through the ceiling yet. And it became a big dilemma of what he was going to do. You know, these days watch 8 hours of a TV show on Netflix all at once, right? Or you might go to the theater and see a really long event. There's a show touring the country right now that is literally 24 hours long. So, you know, we're used to these long marathons. But back then in the late 80s, when Tony Kushner was first writing this play, there was only one other play really that existed at the time that was that long, which was Nicholas Nickleby, which was done in England, which was also two parts and very long. And so, you know, it was considered a very bizarre, and it was a choice to split it into two plays. And it was very controversial amongst his collaborators at the time. But, you know, they eventually realized that that's what was needed to tell this full story.
So the production that's in New York right now, they perform both plays every day, and you can go see either the first one or the second one or both, right?
No, that's so no, there's a bunch of different ways that you can do it. How they are doing it is this: on Wednesdays and on weekends, they do the full play, because you have to do a matinee of one play, dinner break, evening of the other. And then on Thursday, they do the first play, and on Friday, they do the second play, right? So it's sort of, you can either do a marathon or you can see it split up. So I saw a marathon of it last week, and then I'm seeing it on two separate nights in a couple of weeks. And you, they may have changed this, but at least when the tickets initially went on sale, you had to buy tickets to both, and you got the same seats for both.
Well, I had noted from Ben Brantley's review, I actually just copy pasted this into my notes because I thought it was such a fantastic statement on sort of the way culture has evolved to the point it is today and where the play fits into it. He said in his New York Times review, watching both parts of Angels, Millennium Approaches and Perestroika on one Saturday, as I didn't feel much different from falling into a fat novel by Dickens or Donna Tartt or binge watching a quality soap on Netflix. And it just seems so perfect that the culture has caught up with this play in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really true. I mean, we think nothing of spending an entire weekend watching, you know, three seasons of Battlestar Galactica or whatever, right? I'm showing my age by having Battlestar Galactica be my pop culture reference. maybe I should say, you know, we think nothing of losing a whole weekend to watching two seasons of Orange is the New Black or whatever. But yeah. I mean, that really is, we do consume pop culture in a very different way. Now, I will say, where I would disagree with Ben Brantley, and I loved that review, and I love this production, but where I would disagree is simply that theater, even great theater, does require a different kind of attention, right? You can't, like, turn to look at your phone. You know, you really have to fully engage with it. But what I will say is, I caught a plane back to New York City from being on book tour. So I caught a plane back to New York City. So I had to get up at 4 a.m. and then I landed at the airport and I went right from the airport to the theater. And then I spent, you know, 8 hours watching play with a 2-hour dinner break in the middle. And my attention never flagged once. It's like, once you're on that train, it's a great train to be on, and it trundles forward with furious motion.
You talked to a lot of the people from this production during the time when they were in the London production for the book. Mm-hmm. Did you talk to any of them about the ordeal of it? I mean, the memorization and the talking for that many hours in one day, and just the physical and mental doing it of it all.
One of the things that was really fun about reporting that chapter and writing it and doing the interviews for the chapter that's on that specific production is, you know, that was the chapter where we were for once able to interview people while they were actually performing the play. And, you know, every other production we're profiling in the history of the play has closed already. Some of them closed 25 or more years ago, you know, and here you have people who are right in the middle of it. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why that chapter leads with a quote by Andrew Garfield, who's playing Prior Walter, the main character in the play. And this is the line. How am I doing? I don't know. It's, you know, it makes you bigger. It makes you grow, doesn't it? It kind of breaks you open. Most of the foundational feeling is gratitude, to be honest. So we start right in that place of like, I am in the middle of this gigantic undertaking, and it's so gigantic, I can't even describe how I'm doing while I'm doing it. Many of the actors said to us, you know, when you do those marathons, you don't have a good show or a bad show. It's like you have a brilliant show for 5 minutes and a terrible show for 2 minutes and an incredible show for another minute in your car. You know, it's just, there's, it's so much bigger than you. You just have to kind of like open yourself to it and have that experience.
Have you seen the play done badly?
No, I mean, I'm sure there are bad productions of the play. You know what I mean? I will say that there's a Millennium Approaches, the first half of the play is a like almost perfect play in its structure and its line by line writing. And so even it's kind of like Shakespeare's Twelfth Night in that like even a mediocre production of it is still kind of brilliant because the play is just so perfect and it kind of can carry that production along. Perestroika is a much harder play to do. It's much messier. The structure is more chaotic. There's a lot of magic realism in it. It's much stranger. The language is more complicated. You have to have like a top-notch group of people who are working really hard to make Perestroika really good. I think it is an equally brilliant play. It's just a very different undertaking. So I would say that, you know, if you're watching the show, the chances that you're going to see a bad Millennium are very slim.
I have not seen the New York production, but from the pictures I've seen of it, it looks like a very minimalist approach. And there's so much going on in the play and so many different settings in the play that I could see doing a very maximalist production design oriented version of it could be very, very difficult to execute. Has it been done that way?
Oh, sure. I mean, and I would say that, you know, as minimal as the production on Broadway looks at times, there's a ton of money in that set. You know, there's a lot going on in that show. It's just organized in such a way that the scenery is frequently not representational. In the original Broadway production, directed by George C. Wolfe 25 years ago, you know, that show had a different set for every scene. They came on these sort of carts and then they would do the scene and the carts would come off and then they'd switch the set on that cart, you know, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth. It had a lot of set pieces and it was in a much smaller theater, the Walter Kerr, which is one of the smallest theaters on Broadway. And a lot of our chapter of the Broadway production, a lot of it is about like, how do we even fit these two shows into here? Some of the sets had to be thrown away. What they eventually did was they, you know, while you were doing Millennium, the set for Perestroika would literally be hanging from the ceiling. And then when Millennium Approaches was over, the crew would come out and they would sort of swap those sets. Some of the sets had to be stored in a truck in an alleyway next to the theater. You know, if you take that maximalist approach, you know, there's a lot of stuff you have to fit places. But a lot of productions go with a very minimal approach where, you know, a scene's are just when they're outside on a park bench, all you got is a park bench. Or when they're on the phone, all you've got is a phone. And then there's a production that toured for many years from a group in the Netherlands, directed by the experimental theater director named Ivo van Hove. And his approach to it was to basically have absolutely no scenery or props at all. I mean, it was like he had almost nothing on that stage and it was as minimal as it could possibly be. Often the props were mimed. You know, he really wanted to strip the play down to its very, very minimal essence and see what was there.
Is the experience of seeing both on the same day, I mean, by the time you get to the end of it, are emotionally exhausting, physically exhausting? I mean, what did you feel like when it was over?
Well, I mean, you're really, you know, it's how do I put this? Part of the wonder of the play is that the emotional, spiritual, physical state that it puts you in by the time you're done watching it is very hard to describe and put into words. It is an ineffable experience, the kind of experience that you really only get through seeing brilliant, complicated theater. And it is that feeling is then further expanded by how long you've been doing it. The combination of the complexity of the experience and the duration really adds up to a sort of unique feeling. Like you've been, I don't know, you kind of feel like you've been broken apart into a million pieces and you're regathering yourself. As you applaud for the actors during the curtain call, you really feel awake and alive in a totally different way when it's over. This is a play in which you as an audience member and the characters on stage both are passing through every emotional experience there is, including death, and at the same time, it's one of the funniest plays ever written. So, the emotional complexity of that stretched out over a long time is a really bizarre thing to put yourself through, and totally 100% worth it. You really do feel less alienated, more alive, more connected to the world around you when it's over.
You and Dan Coyce from Slate co-wrote the book. What did you do? Did you talk to people together? Did you sort of cut the list up and talk to people separately? How was your approach to talking to people?
Oh man. Well, really we had a bunch of Google spreadsheets and Google Docs that we put interviews in. Without the cloud, we would have been in a lot of trouble. This book was really made possible by the internet. What we did at first was we just started brainstorming every person we could think of that we thought we should talk to, and we put it in a spreadsheet, and then we would just claim them, be like, I'm going to track this down. I'm going to track this person down. Then as we started each focusing on particular areas of the play's history, usually we would do most of the interviews for that particular area, right? So like Dan, for example, did a lot of the work on the HBO miniseries that was directed by Mike Nichols and reporting that out, right? So like he did most of those interviews because that was the section he was working on, right? But it didn't always work out that way. Sometimes you would track someone down, but then your schedule didn't work out and the other person's did, and we would hop on it and switch back and forth. And then we were always reading all of the interviews the other person did.
And you took a little bit broader approach to putting the play in some kind of historical and cultural context than what you would typically see in something like this. Was that something that evolved, or did you start from that idea of talking to people like Rick Perlstein, put this in a context?
Well, this piece started as a cover story for Slate.com. And that cover story was about 15,000 words, and it was based on a draft that was 40,000 words, which is how we knew we had a book. In that process, we could only really focus on the story of the play itself and the creation of the play. But this is a play that emerges from a very specific context, and it is a deeply political play filled with deeply political characters, and it's a thematically rich play. And so we always felt like if we were going to do a book, we were going to really explore the context that the play existed in. That came from a couple of different places. For one thing, this is a play I've taught before, and watching college freshmen grapple with this play, and they have no idea who Roy Cohn was, they don't know who Ethel Rosenberg was, they don't really understand the AIDS crisis, they don't really understand the Reagan Revolution, I wanted to do a book that someone in my position as a teacher could just hand it to them and be like, it's all right here, go read it, you know what I mean? I also, that's a history that I lived through and I find really fascinating. So that's one place it came from. And the second place we were coming from is, pretty early on, it just became sort of clear that this book is sort of like a biography of a play. you know? And just like a biography of a person will place them in their social and historical context, we feel like the story of this play would more come to life once it was placed in its social and historical context.
The politics in the play, I guess, comes in a couple of different areas, and I'm sure you have a much more sophisticated sense of this, having talked to so many of these people along the way that have been in the play and that have had different relationships with the play. But it strikes me that the Lewis character talks in political philosophy, and the Joe character talks in political actuality.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think each of the characters expresses themselves through politics. These are deeply political people who, you know, the language that they use is a political language, and they think about politics and they have a politics, you know, like each of the characters has a political point of view. And so, you know, Lewis and Joe, who, of course, end up briefly as a couple in the play, you know, you can really see a lot about who they are from the way that they discuss politics. Lewis is conflicted and tormented and Talmudic and contradicting himself and trying to figure out how to advance through the world and, you know, what theory can help him and what theories can't help him and how they clash with each other and stuff like that. Whereas Joe, you know, who is a Republican, I think that's important that he's a Republican and Lewis is a leftist. You know, Joe is very interested in the sort of concrete nature of politics. He is much less interested in political, you know, political philosophy. He's much less interested in politics as an idea and more as politics as an action. And that sort of echoes throughout the whole play.
From the original Broadway production to the Mike Nichols HBO production to the current Broadway production, what kind of evolution do you see either in individual characters or in the way the production in general has been presented?
That's a great question. There's a sort of number of different ways to answer it. The big thing is to simply say that Tony Kushner has rewritten the second play, Perestroika, many times. Since the Broadway production, he in fact did rewrites on it for the production that's on Broadway right now. And he also rewrote it when it was in London. He's, you know, so there's this interesting thing that Perestroika is in many ways a play about, you know, change, of course, and about nothing ever being fixed, and it is a play itself that will never be fixed and is always changing. So that's one of the really wild things. If you go to see this production, you know, on Broadway, and then you were to go to a used bookstore and find a copy of Perestroika from 25 years ago, you'll note tons of differences. Some small,
some large.
So what
are the changes? I mean, is it syntax? Is it things that are entirely new exchanges? What?
You know, I haven't tracked all of them because there are a lot. And Perestroika for Broadway was rewritten from, you know, the version that was at the Taper a year earlier. There's one particular scene, the second act of the play, where the angel communicates to Pryor the why she wants Pryor to be a prophet and the prophecy she wants him to espouse. That scene has been rewritten many, 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 many times. The scene in the play is called the Anti-Migratory Epistle, and it's where the angel tells Pryor that the, you know, the God has abandoned the angels and the angels want humans to stop moving around, to stop changing, to stop migrating, to stop intermarrying in order to try to convince God to come back. And that's the prophecy that Pryor will struggle with through the whole play and eventually reject at the end of the play. That scene's been rewritten a million times.
And it plays as camp in the miniseries, right?
Yeah, a little bit. It definitely does. I mean, there's a sense of humor in that scene. There's no moment in this play that doesn't have a sense of humor, right? So there's a moment, you know, one of the brilliant things about that is that you have this angel coming forward and speaking in this, you know, I, and I am the magnificence, and I've come to you, prophet, in this sort of highly elevated language. But then she, you know, her assistants have forgotten to give Pryor the dream that will show him where his sacred instruments as a prophet are in his apartment, right? And then when she goes to show them to him, she blows up his refrigerator, and he gets really mad at her about it. You know, he says, "You've cracked the refrigerator. You've released who knows how many fluorocarbons. I'm going to lose my security deposit," or whatever. You know, so there's always a sense of humor in it that's undercutting the kind of seriousness and the elevated nature of the language. But that both of those things have always been true about that scene, but word choices, structure, things like that have changed around a lot. There's been a lot of little changes to Joe's scenes in Perestroika, nothing that completely revises the character or anything like that. You know, the plot remains the plot, but it shades him in different colors and reveals different nuances.
And Joe is the Mormon lawyer.
Joe's the Mormon lawyer, yes, the closeted Mormon lawyer who, in the second half of the play, begins an affair with one of the other play's characters and sort of begins to step away from the hyper-conservatism and denial of his upbringing.
In the scene that you're talking about with the angel, do you understand the book that the angel is directing him to find buried under the tile in his kitchen to be the Book of Mormon, or to at least be an allegory of the Book of Mormon?
No, I mean, I think that there's a way that it echoes the Book of Mormon, right? That the journey to find the book is meant to reference Joseph Smith, you know, finding the plates on which were written the Book of Mormon. But the content of the book itself, which again has to do with this prophecy of stop moving, the sort of ultra conservative reactionary idea that if humans can just stop moving forward and stop progressing, you know, then we can sort of rewind the clock and bring God back. You know, that content is not the same as the content of the Book of Mormon. And the other thing that's different with the book is that the book is put into Pryor. It becomes a part of him, like a physical part of him. And the book has to be kind of removed from him when he rejects the prophecy.
There is that angel in the play, but the play is called Angels, plural, in America.
Right.
Is that specific? I mean, is that an indication that she's not the only angel?
Well, there is a scene later on in the play in heaven where all of the other actors in the play play angels, where the seven other actors in the play play the angels, and Pryor comes and sees them. And in that scene, the angels are kind of like semi-competent Bolshevik bureaucrats at the end of the Soviet Union. You know, they're just trying to keep the water and the heat on as everything goes to shit around them. So there are some other angels, and there's another line in the play where Lewis says, you know, no God, no angels in America. The title predates any of the content of the play. The first idea that Tony Kushner had was for that title. And it was also the title of a poem that he wrote that he won't let anyone ever see, after having a dream about a friend of his who had died of AIDS. And in that dream, his friend was in a hospital room and an angel crashed through the ceiling. And that he woke up from that dream and he wrote that poem, and that poem was called Angels in America. And a couple years later, he decided to write a play also called Angels in America that would feature that scene.
Some of the individual characters in the play that have gotten a lot of attention over the years, probably Roy Cohn would be first among those, partly because he's, as far as I know, the only character, well, I guess Ethel Rosenberg started to say, yeah, the only character in the play based on a real person, but the Ethel Rosenberg is kind of a ghost or something.
Yeah, the ghost of Ethel Rosenberg, whether you think that comes from Roy's imagination or she's a real ghost, either way, that is a representation of a historical figure.
But Roy Cohn is the character from the play that people probably most talk about. It's who Al Pacino played in the miniseries and who Nathan Lane is playing in the Broadway production right now. Tell me about Roy Cohn.
Yeah, absolutely. So Roy Cohn is a real life figure. He came to prominence as part of the prosecution team that tried Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And he was in his, I think, mid-20s at that point. And then he kind of caught the eye of Joseph McCarthy and became counsel for him during the HUAC hearings. After that, he went into private practice in New York City, where beyond being a lawyer, he became an extremely powerful Republican fixer and mover and shaker and power broker. He was extremely good at cultivating relationships with powerful figures, many of whom were his clients. And many of those clients, for example, were mob bosses. And another one of his clients, who he mentored very thoroughly in his dark arts, is our current president of the United States. When the Trump companies were fighting a housing discrimination lawsuit, Trump enlisted Roy Cohn, and Roy Cohn became his lawyer. And, you know, it's Roy Cohn who kind of taught him to always fight back, always attack, countersue, lie if you have to. When you lose, declare victory, you know, move forward, hit the other guy 10 times as hard. You know, that's the Roy Cohn school of doing business. The other thing about Roy Cohn is that he was a closeted gay man, and that he died of AIDS. And it was as he was dying of AIDS that his seeking treatment for AIDS, he was let into an experimental study of AZT. You know, the press found out about it, and he was outed through that. So he was outed because he was dying of AIDS. And one of the things you really see Kushner struggle with in both our book and in the play itself is with this figure of Roy Cohn, who's a complicated person. And, you know, who there's an interview where Tony Kushner says something to the extent of, I'm going to paraphrase here, you know, the fact that he was outed and died of AIDS makes him part of the gay community, whether we want him or not. You know, and there's a real effort to struggle with this character and his humanity and his evil and his legacy and put those complexities on stage. And one of the things that Tony Kushner does that's really smart is that, you know, he gives Roy Cohn a lot of the best lines, and he's really like a fun, incredibly entertaining character to watch. The other thing that's really important in terms of Roy Cohn on stage, and this, you sort of alluded to this by talking about him being played by Al Pacino or Nathan Lane, is that, you know, Cohn is designed to be a bravura performance by a star. It's written to be that. And, you know, Kushner told me one time when I interviewed him, you know, the reason why Roy Cohn needs to be a star is that Roy Cohn, the real figure, is a star in the world of the play. You know, so you're borrowing that person's celebrity and you're borrowing that person's persona to a certain extent when you put them on stage in the role.
And it's really, really big.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It is a really, really big role, and it's big in two ways, right? There's a lot of lines. There's a lot of really long monologues. You know, the first scene of the play after the prologue begins with this kind of incredible monologue where Roy Cohn is juggling 8 phone calls and trying to get people tickets to see, you know, difficult to get into Broadway shows, and screaming at his law partners and, you know, all sorts of other things. And that's just the starting place. The other thing the actor playing Roy Cohn has to do is actually chart the entire kind of process of dying of AIDS. He starts kind of at the top of his powers, and then the next time you see him, he gets the diagnosis that he has AIDS. And then throughout the two plays, you watch him gradually decline and die. He dies on stage.
Tony Kushner wrote the plays in the 90s about the 80s, and they have these 90s titles. I mean, Millennium is a very 90s word, and yep. Perestroika is a very 90s word.
Yep.
Do they feel very 90s today? Because All I see is the 80s when I watch the miniseries. I don't so much see the lens of the 90s.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's really interesting that, you know, he started writing the play in earnest in 1988. And to some extent, because he keeps rewriting Perestroika, it's never been finished, right? Or it's been finished many, many times and then tinkered with since then. And even though he started writing it in 1988, it takes place in 1985, 86, except for the ending, which takes place in 1990. So in a weird way, it's always been looking backward. It's always been a period piece, you know. At the same time, the conflicts and themes in it are universal. And they're always going to be with us because they're a part of human nature. You know, this idea of, you know, how do we balance what we owe to ourselves and what we owe to other people, for example? Or how do we approach the inevitability of change, both positive and negative, change that could include death, you know, or from the end of the play, what does it mean to expand the idea of citizenship? What does citizenship actually mean? What are the obligations of citizenship? What are the parameters of citizenship? Who gets to be a citizen? You know, those kinds of ideas and themes and questions, those are always going to be with us. I saw the production on Broadway. I don't think that the clothes look particularly 80s to me, for example, you know. I don't think they're really trying to necessarily evoke the 1980s in the set and costumes. They're sort of gesturing to it, but they're not treating it like a period piece. You know, they're treating it like a Shakespeare play, like a classic that they're going into and reinvestigating and reinterpreting.
I think one of the big differences in 25 years ago and now is that this production is occurring in a world where gay culture has a much different popular appeal and a much more currency than maybe what it had 25 years ago.
Absolutely. And this play is part of the reason why that's true.
I hadn't you thought know? About it that way, but yeah, I'm sure that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't want to think that this play didn't do that single-handedly. Do you know what I mean? But,
no, this... RuPaul's Drag Race is responsible for a lot of that.
RuPaul's Drag Race is. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, so. And even, you know, things that I have a complicated relationship to, like Will and Grace are partly responsible. Right. So, you know, but if you know, Angels in America is this play that was, you know, in the New York Review of Books and in the New York Times every week and being discussed on Charlie Rose and 60 Minutes and everything like that. And it was a play that was unapologetically about gay men whose protagonist was an effeminate ex-drag queen, you know, and who for a character for whom effeminacy and fabulousness were a source of strength. They weren't pathologized like, you know, Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs. You know, they weren't a place of weakness or of sadness. His strength is his effeminacy. That's a really friggin' wild thing to drop into American pop culture in 1993. You know what I mean? And I do think that wasn't the only thing that had a transformative effect, but that did help transform the way that gay people, specifically gay men, were represented in popular culture. And a lot of others, you know, there's all sorts of other things that have happened, like, you know, the fight for gay marriage or medical advances in the treatment of HIV or other pop culture stuff like RuPaul's Drag Race, Will and Grace, even as problematic as it can be, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, the original one, I mean. And, you know, so one of the things that it's circling around to as the play comes forward again is that there have been a lot of advances, both in terms of gay rights and in terms of the AIDS crisis and in terms of gay representation. At the same time, you know, there's lots of legal barriers left to tear down. There's still many states where you can fire someone just for being gay. And what I think the play feels like now, when you see it now, is an invitation to rethink and to question and to expand our notion of citizenship. You know, when Pryor says we will be citizens at the end of the play, it really, to me, invites, you know, a new way of looking at that sentence. And what does it mean to be a citizen? And who are we going to let be a citizen?
Tony Kushner is all through the book. I assume that you and Dan talked to him many times or few times for many hours. How much did it open other doors for talking to people that Tony was involved at the beginning?
I don't know necessarily, just because, I mean, there's a couple of people that Tony, you know, helped us reach out to. And of course, every email we sent to anyone asking them to do it, you know, we'd list some of the people we were interviewing. We'd always make sure his name was on the list because we're not stupid, right? You know, but what was really interesting throughout this process is almost every person we interview was like, oh, you should talk to this person. I've got their email address. I'll write them and tell them to talk to you. So, you know, every one of our interview subjects was really generous with helping open doors to us.
What do you think about oral history as a mechanism? I mean, obviously, you didn't have to do it this way. You could have done it as a narrative style book, but I'm seeing a lot more of it. I mean, even though for something that's been around for a long time, it seems to be a very popular form right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's having a moment right now, which, you know, as someone who does theater and thinks theater is underappreciated, I would like to say that if people like oral histories, they should try reading plays. But, you know,
it is. It's like a play.
It's like a play. Yeah. I mean, there's a number of reasons why we chose to do this as an oral history that I think point to what makes for a good oral history. We had, 250 people who are all really great talkers, you know, because they're theater people. So they know how to talk and they know how to talk well and to tell stories and stuff like that. And they're all talking about one of the most important things that ever happened to them, professionally or artistically, and in many cases, personally. You know, there's no one who we interviewed who is like, meh, I sort of remember Angels in America. You know, for everyone, it was this extremely important part of their lives. And we also had multiple instances in which people disagree. You know, one of the things that's great about an oral history is when you find those moments of conflict, and then you can put those moments of conflict on the page. And so, you know, we just always knew from the start that this was the right form for this story. I think oral histories tend to not work or to be kind of dull when everyone agrees, when they don't all seem to really care that much. They're just sort of like telling you this story that doesn't have high stakes for them. I also think that oral histories are their own art, and they're complicated, you know, editing all these voices together so it sounds like you're in one long kind of rousing cocktail party where everyone's had a drink or two and really wants to tell you about the play. Like, that is a challenge, you know, to break up these quotes and to edit them together and everything like that. And, you know, one of the things that we really looked at in doing that was, you know, documentaries that we really loved, particularly Errol Morris's The Thin Blue Line, which, you know, takes a lot of different interviews in this kind of kaleidoscopic approach.
Well, you mentioned The Thin Blue Line, and a lot of the documentaries that I really like have these talking heads that come in at just the right time and tell you their version of it. Jim Miller, who has written a number of oral histories, has started working some in audio form in a podcast series he's got called Origin or Origins. Have you thought about a second life for any of the material that you've got? Do you have the audio for most of your interviews?
We have the audio for some. Some of them were transcribed, you know, while the person was talking. So we don't have all of them, which would mean that, you know, some of them would have to be. So if we're going to do an audio version of it, we're going to, you know, have to hire a bunch of actors to play all the parts, which is exciting. I mean, one of the things that we're doing for our book events when we're on book tour is, you know, when we come to a bookstore or a city near you, we bring together a cast of, you know, local folks to read the chapters as a staged reading. And it's a lot more fun and vibrant than a regular book event, we find. And so we would love to find a way to, you know, record the book that way, whether it's actually reading the book live over a series of nights at a venue and then, you know, recording it with the audience and then podcasting that, or doing it as a traditional audiobook.
Hey, is there an audiobook version?
There is not. currently.
So that's something that you haven't, you would have to still work out to be able to do.
And have you
thought about doing a film version of this at some point?
I don't think we could do it. I think we would have had to have been filming all the time to be able to do a film version of this. You know, there just isn't enough archival footage out there to make it visually interesting. But I would love to find an audio format for this book that we felt was appropriate. And we're currently pursuing both doing it as an audio book and doing it as maybe like a taped live event with a somewhat edited script over multiple nights and then podcasting it.
Well, this is very interesting. It's a tremendous amount of work. I think you said 250 individual people you talked to, and I'm sure thousands of quotes to move around like jigsaw pieces. It's an amazing amount of work that you and Dan Coyce put together in this very elegant, readable, funny, great book. So I'm anxious to get through the rest of it.
Awesome.
Really appreciate you talking to me.
Well, thank you so much. It was, I will say, doing the book was a lot of work, but it was a really, it was a joy to do while we did it. It was not painful. It was, if anything, particularly since Trump was elected halfway through our working on it, working on a book about the power of art in difficult times, because of course it came out of the Reagan administration and the AIDS crisis, and the power of art in that context was incredibly rejuvenating, actually. And so I'm really happy the book is out in the world. I'm really happy you're enjoying it so far.
Maybe you can get Donald Trump to read Roy Cohn when you do the audio version.
I mean, if we knew if Donald Trump knew how to read, then it might be worth pursuing. But since he's clearly actually functionally illiterate, I think that would actually be a problem.